Good morning, everybody. Time for Knife River News from the Knife River Heritage and Cultural Center. I'm Paul von Gertz. I'm the president of the board of the Knife River Heritage Center in Knife River, of course, and we bring you the news from Knife River that airs every second Friday of every month here on KTWH 99.5, and then it's repeated the following Sunday at 1 o'clock. So, got that, second Friday of every month at 9 o'clock, and then repeated the following Sunday at 1 p.m. Usually about 20 minutes. I've got some more time to spend with you this morning, do some change in scheduling. But we have plenty of news, and if we don't have enough, I'll make some up. How's that? No, I won't do that. Everything is accurate as I know here, because everything I put in our newsletter ends up in our archives at the Knife River Heritage Center. So this is going well into the future, I hope, and so we want it to be as accurate as possible. And with that, I will start with our most current newsletter, which is March of 2021. And this one was sent out on April 1st with breaking news that a lighthouse is considered for Knife Island. I know many of you have seen the island and kind of wonder why there isn't a lighthouse there. And oftentimes I've wondered that too, because I've come close to hitting it in the fog with my own boats. Let me go on with you about the lighthouse for Knife River. It is true, a lighthouse for Knife River was considered, but the date was April of 07, which makes this whole story about a lighthouse for Knife River an April Fool's joke. There. Okay. Here's a little bit more information about that lighthouse for Knife Island that was proposed back in April of 07. 1907, that is. Well, it was in April of 07 that the federal government was considering a lighthouse for Knife Island. This was after a long list of shipwrecks in the vicinity of the island. The ship Madeline was wrecked in the spring of 1834, the Rosedale in 1893, Penobscot in 1899, Niagara in 1904, and later the Thomas Matham in 1926. Magnetic attraction off Knife Island is believed to have been the culprit in several of these wrecks. Bet you didn't know that there are that many wrecks in the vicinity of Knife Island, about six. Anyway, the government asked Lieutenant Colonel Graham Fitch, Chief of the Army Corps of Engineers in Duluth, to study the possibility of a lighthouse on Knife Island. He came out against the idea, claiming it was unnecessary at this time. So that was the last heard of a lighthouse on Knife Island until this issue of the Heritage Center newsletter. Many thanks to our historian, Knife River Heritage Cultural Center historian Todd Lindo, for the research behind this story and proving once again history can be really interesting. Okay, that is our lead story, April Fool's joke. Hope you thought that was a joke. I did. Okay, speaking of jokes, the Great Knife River Train Robbery, my second story for the March issue. Not too many people are aware of the Great Knife River Train Robbery because as the investigation into it unfolded, several Knife River people became implicated. If this, quote, inside job, unquote, as later called, was become known to the public, it could have been an embarrassment for a normally quiet and peaceful town of Knife River. The robbery, as best I can recall as an eyewitness, took place in late June of 2003. A Bud car, that's that small self-propelled car, owned by the North Shore Scenic Railroad, was filled with members of the three Duluth and Superior Rotary Clubs, along with their guests. It was en route to Two Harbors to join the Two Harbors Rotary Club in celebrating the 10th anniversary of their charter as a Rotary Club. Well, as the Bud car rounded the turn into Knife River, the engineer was alerted to a flare burning in the middle of the track, about where the depot is. The engineer applied the brakes and the car came to a stop. Immediately, two masked riders on horseback rode up to the car with at least one of the riders shooting a pistol wildly in the air. The other rider, who appeared to be a woman, acted as lookout. The first rider boarded the car and walked down the aisle, gruffly demanding money. One wide-eyed passenger reportedly asked the gunman if his gun was real, and the response was, "Want to find out?" Well, within minutes, the robbers had completed their assault on the train riders and rode away with a bag of loot. An investigation of the incident followed, and the trail soon led back to a, quote, inside job. First, the robbers fit the general description of Norman, Butch Southard, and the woman, his daughter, Sarah Sundance Southard of Knife River. Both were accomplished horse riders, and Butch was originally from Chicago, where investigators have surmised he learned his trade. A forensic study of the flare remnants used to stop the train proved to be a marine distress flare, probably from a Knife River boat owner. Further investigation revealed that two members of the Knife River community were members of the Rotary Club of Duluth, Rich Ojard and myself, Paul von Kurtz. And a third, Norman Southern, was a charter member of the Two Harbors Club. Well, it was alleged the three would have known about the Budcar trip, its passengers, and its schedule. Now, the three of us also had boats in the marina that would have had the required U.S. Coast Guard distress flares. Things got a bit dicey when I produced photos of the robbery for the Duluth Rotary Club newsletter. And so the question rose how I happened to be at the scene. My response was that I was innocently photographing monarch butterflies in the field around the depot at the time of the robbery. Well, that was met with skepticism. The story had a happy ending, though, when Butch and Sundance learned of Rotary's goal of ridding the world of polio through a global fundraising effort. This resulted in the bag of loot taken arriving at my doorstep, clearly marked for Polio Plus, which was the name of the initiative to rid the world of polio. It counted and totaled $172. Well, a sidelight to this whole story is that Rotarian Earl Rogers, who owned the Duluth Gravel Agency at the time, was on board with a group of East Bloc Rotarians whose trip to the U.S. was arranged by Earl. They had expressed an interest in seeing the Wild West, and they were not disappointed. One of them was even get a photo, which I have in my newsletter. So there you have it, the Great Knife River Train Robbery. Bet you didn't know that. Okay, other news. Excuse me. Well, since its inception in 2018, the Knife River Heritage Center has invested time and money in restoring the train depot to demonstrate to all the naysayers that we could do it. So now that we're taken seriously with a beautifully and accurately restored 1900s depot, we can put some energy into creating a long overdue website. Well, it's hard to believe that as a nonprofit, which depends on donations of time and money, that we could have achieved what we have done without a web window to the world. So, one of our goals for 2021 was to create a website. And we'll do this with the same Scandinavian frugality we have demonstrated so far in everything we've done. The Heritage Center will create our own site template, write the text, source the images, and hire out page design and programming. But we'll be able to update our site ourselves. Following our local buy local policy, we've hired Blackwell Digital of Two Harbors, Breakwell Digital of Two Harbors, to provide the needed outside professional service and host the site. So we're asking for someone to help with the cost of building and hosting the site for the next year, so for 2021, 12 months anyway, in exchange for sponsoring credit on the site. The sponsorship would be $750. And in effect, until the site is updated when the center is officially open sometime next year. Okay, let's keep moving along here. Here's a story you'll enjoy if you enjoy nature. Excuse me. Spring allergies. Bobcats in Knife River. Yes, that's right. There is a bobcat in Knife River. Unfortunately, deceased. Andy Zaborski from Knife River saw the cat's body in the median from the southbound 61 Expressway about a block east of where Expressway 61 passes over the Knife River. He told me about it, and I immediately called Joe Russell from Knife River, a retired DNR Parks and Trails manager. Well, he immediately retrieved the body and called a DNR conservation officer. Bobcats are a protected species, and the DNR will determine what will be done with the cat. I was curious if a bobcat in Knife River was a rarity or not, so I called Bill Berg, also from Knife River, and he is a retired DNR wildlife research biologist with a field of study in large predators and fur bearers, also ruffed and sharp-tailed grouse. Bill also lives in Knife River, and we are very fortunate to have both Bill and Joe for their knowledge of wildlife, the environment, and outdoor recreation. Well, Bill says there are a lot more bobcats than you think there are around here. Every winter, Bill says, I have a bobcat feeding on a deer carcass I hang in the tree after deer hunting season. I never see them, but obviously I recognize their tracks. They're very secretive. They're drawn here by lots of cottontail bunnies and abundant deer. A 20-pound bobcat can ambush and pull down a 100-pound deer with no problem, said Bill. There are more bobcats in northern Minnesota now than probably ever, mainly due to milder winters and more prey. The converse is true for lynx, with milder winters and fewer snowshoe hares, their main prey. Bill wanted to say that when he started the DNR in the late 60s, the main bobcat range was central Minnesota, particularly Pine and Aitkin counties, essentially None are very rare for northern Minnesota. As winters gradually warmed, bobcats took advantage of more deer and less snow. They now extend into Ontario and especially northwestern Minnesota and southern Manitoba. Well, I had to ask Bill how a 20 to 35, 40-pound bobcat could take down a deer many times its size, and he said he could tell me, but the details would be a little bit gory. Okay, now if gory details bother you, can turn down the volume right now and come back in about a minute, okay? Because here goes how a bobcat can take down a deer. Bill said anyone with a house cat knows how they love to hide in ambush. And anyone with a pet cat else with claws knows what damage even a small cat can inflict. Because bobcats, and house cats too, have small feet, they literally flounder in deep snow. In contrast, a lynx with its huge feet is well seated for deep, soft snow and can chase prey like squirrels and snowshoe hares. But the bobcat usually ambushes its prey. It perches perfectly still on a tree branch above a deer trail and waits, and waits and waits. When a deer walks beneath the branch, the bobcat drops on the deer's neck, wraps its legs around the neck, digs in its very long claws, and hangs on, going along for a ride. Well, the bobcat then bites the lower neck, piercing usually a jugular vein, and bleeds out that deer until it drops. Bill then said and went on to say, I've seen a few places where this has happened, but have never seen it actually occur. But I have seen where blood has squirted 15 to 20 feet high in trees and brush. Now go have lunch, said Bill. Okay, you can turn up your volume now. So, I thank Bill Berg for this information and the descriptive manner in which it was presented. Fortunately, I'm feeling a little bit faint after having read that, and I think I've got to rest for just a second here. Whew, okay. Feeling better, just a couple deep breaths. Now, it's fortunate the body of the bobcat that was hit in the median of the expressway above Knife River was not badly damaged. This will improve its chances of being mounted and used for educational purposes. So, bobcats. All right, next story. Knife River history. One thing our Heritage Center wants to do is make history interesting and give you as much or as little information as you would care about the Knife River area. What we have done is we've created some outdoor interpretive displays for our friends, let's say, who visit the center, either by car or even the North Shore Scenic Railroad, can get kind of a brief history of the Knife River area just from our outdoor interpretive signs. We've seen these in almost every interpretive center along trails and so forth. They're about 2 feet by 3 feet, full color, and they're all weather protected. And so we've ordered four of these, and so I want to tell you a little bit about it here. We just got our displays about a week or two ago from Panyard Displays, a family-owned and operated business in Pennsylvania. And they collectively tell the Knife River history in about 600 words. We ordered these displays last fall so that we could begin our educational program this summer while acknowledging a formal opening of our center with static and interactive displays still about a year away. So now, when visitors are here this summer, they can get the short version of Knife River history in about 150 words per display, supported with some really good images. There are many thanks to go to the four individuals or couples who each responded to a challenge of contributing $1,000 to cover about half the cost of each display. Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation paid for the other half under a one-to-one match funding match. Thanks also to Todd Lindahl. Many of you know Todd from Two Harbors here. He's one of our board members and historian for condensing Knife River's history into less than 600 words and for sourcing all the images. And finally, thanks to Randy Ellisted for use of Knife River Campground for use of his forklift and lifting the displays off the 18-wheeler that delivered them. Four displays and local sponsors are as follows. Okay, these displays go in kind of historical order, beginning with Native people. So our first display is devoted to Native Americans and copper mining, and this display was sponsored by Bill and Pat Meyer of Knife River. And the text reads as follows. This is interesting. Native Americans had a presence at Knife River for thousands of years. Their name for the river was Mokoman Subi. I think I've got that pronounced right, which translates into Knife River. Fishing copper deposits for tool making and other natural resources attracted them. A seasonal village was on Granite Point, which today forms the western entry into Knife River Harbor. This village existed at least from 1796 to about 1870. The north shore of Lake Superior remained Native American land until the Treaty of La Pointe in 1854. Once the land was ceded from the natives to the whites, many miners flooded into the region in search of copper, gold, and silver. Only traces of these precious minerals were found, and mining ended in about 1929. The community of Buchanan was established at Knife River in October of 1856. 3 years later, it was a ghost town, but found was a fishing village known as Millie. That name lasted until 1903, when the village became Knife River. I'll have to ask Todd where that name Millie came from. Anyway, I'm glad it was changed to Knife River, because I don't think Millie's probably the best name for a town. Okay, the second display is for dedicated logging on the Alger Smith Railroad, and that was sponsored by Mitch Costley here of Two Harbors. Well, logging around Knife River began in the 1870s. Logs from 1 to 3 miles inland were rolled into Lake Superior and rafted to sawmills in Duluth. Now, many of you may have thought that the logs were rafted or were sent down the Knife River. No, they weren't. They were either rolled into Lake Superior or rafted to sawmills in Duluth. In May of 1898, the Alger Smith Lumber Company built a logging railroad called the Duluth and Northern Minnesota Railway, which interchanged cars with the Duluth and Iron Range Railway at Knife River. It was a common carrier railroad that transported passengers, freight, and forest products. So pine logs from St. Louis, Lake, and Cook Counties were shipped by rail to the company's two large sawmills in Duluth. The village of Knife River grew rapidly with intense logging activity. In 1919, Alger Smith's logging ended, and in 1921, the railroad stopped hauling passengers. Its 100 miles of track were taken up in 1923. Now, this is something interesting here, why Knife River was the busiest North Shore railroad town along the whole North Shore. And that was because it was the only place that two railroads intersected. Now, you had the main line, which became the Duluth Iron, DM&IR. Of course, that runs generally east-west, west-east. And then you also had the Alger Smith logging, which went north and up about 70 miles. And the Alger Smith then intersected the DM, what became a DM&IR railroad, right in Knife River. So we had two railroads that are intersecting in one little town, which made Knife River a pretty busy railroad town. Okay, the third display is on the depot itself. That's sponsored by Bob and Cheryl Ensign of Knife River. Maybe many of you know Bob and Cheryl. They own the River or Island View Resort. Okay, the depot. Construction train of the Duluth and Iron Range Railway reached Knife River in October of 1886. At that time, only a few commercial fishermen were here. In May 1998, a new logging railroad, the Alger Smith Lumber Company's Duluth and Northern Minnesota Railroad, was established at Knife River, and a new community began to take shape. Well, a depot was needed, and so the DNIRR moved its East Duluth Lester Park Depot, built in 87, to Knife River on two flat cars in December of 1899. The depot served both those railroads that I mentioned that intersected, with each railroad sharing the cost of the depot. Well, the depot became the nerve center of town, serving railroad passengers, handling freight, providing telegraph and telephones, later phone service, and displaying the correct Central Standard Time through Western Union. The first post office was also at the depot. Passenger service ended in July of 1961. And many of you may, 50-plus, would remember perhaps riding that passenger train, that went to 1961. Commercial fishing, excuse me, this display was sponsored by Mike and Nancy Ojard. As you know, the Ojards are longtime family Knife River and commercial fishing. Excuse me. Now, spring allergies. Okay, commercial fishing is the oldest continuous enterprise associated with Knife River. The American Fur Company began commercial fishing in 1834, and soon profits exceeded those of furs. In 1939, they established a fish collection station at Knife River. It included a trader, a carpenter for boat building, a cooper for making barrels and crates, and laborers. The American Fur Company provided the boats and fishing gear for local Native Americans who did all the fishing. Company schooners transported the fish to Fond du Lac and far west Duluth for processing. In April 1838, the American Fur Company schooner Madeline was crushed by pack ice at the mouth of the Knife River and so became the first total loss American shipwreck on Lake Superior. Bet you didn't know that. Well, commercial fishing on the Knife River continues today. As many of you know, the lake trout population is no longer, well, they are fished to a limited degree, but the fishing, almost all the fishing on the Knife River is for herring. Okay, volunteers, here's an open invitation for those who would like to help restore the depot, just about all the labor on the depot and the grounds around the Knife River Heritage Center, including our freight building has been volunteer labor, and we sure need more. We've got lots on our plate for the summer, concrete work, some siding, all good stuff. We've got the tools, a lot of camaraderie, and we hope that those of you who might like to help, not necessarily from Knife River, anywhere in Lake County, like some woodworking, enjoy fellowship with others, men and women, would like to help. We'll start about the first week in May. If you'd like to help on the Knife River Depot or any volunteer work associated with the Heritage Center, you can email me at info@krhcc.org. Again, info@krhcc.org. Okay, that's March news. Now I'm going to go back and pick up some other news here for the last few minutes. Let's see here. This goes back to 2019 when we first began our work on the depot. And we wanted to let people know that we were going to be very accurate in our historical replication of the depot. The Knife River Depot will be historically accurate in appearance going back to about 1910. The depot agent's bay, there's a bay or bump out, like a bay window. That was removed at one time, but we put it back in. So that makes the depot more historically accurate than what you see it today. Let's see here. We've also put a peak roof over that bay window, as it was shown in original drawings. We painted the building original gray with windows trimmed in green. The windows were custom made to replicate the original. Each window cost about $1,000. We had fundraising that, and individuals wishing to honor loved ones were able to provide $1,000 each for 9 windows. So our windows are very, very accurate. We're really, really proud of them. I don't know, let me kind of go through and find some more interesting snippets of information here from about the last 5 minutes that I have. Let me see here. Here we go. Here's something. Here's a did you know. Did you know that from 1966 through 1970, nearly the entire crew of the historic steam tug Energy was from Knife River? Adolph Odegaard was captain, and Ivor Peterson was its relief captain. Harvey Odegaard was chief engineer. Alvin Skadberg was the fireman deckhand, and Norman Hack Lind was linesman. Two others comprised the crew in there from Two Harbors. Well, we think that's kind of neat that the crew is basically almost all from Knife River. Okay, here. Now, here's another story that I want folks to know, that Knife River is rebuilding its what we call gas boats. While we've been focused on rebuilding a depot and restoring Crusader, that's the fish tug on Knife River, several Knife River men have been rebuilding 3 of Knife River's gas boats that have long been part of Knife River's heritage. Now, here's a point of clarification. The term gas boat refers to open, round-bottom skiff up to about 25 feet that are a variation of the Mackinac fishing boats that evolved at the opposite end of the lake. The Mackinacs were very seaworthy and powered by sail. Well, once gas engines became available, the term Mackinac would no longer apply to boats of the Mackinac design, and so distinguished from the sail-powered Mackinac, the term gas boat began to be used. Further definition, the term fish tug refers to commercial fishing boats large enough to have an enclosed cabin. And that's why you hear us oftentimes refer to the 35-foot Crusader as a fish tug. Well, 2 of the 3 Knife River gas boats have been stored, while the 3rd one is under restoration. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about the 2 that have been completed. Star is 20 foot in length and built in 1934 by the Kivila family in Mohawk, Michigan, for fishing the offshore waters of Isle Royale. Its design reflected the conditions of fishing in rough offshore waters. It's a double ender, which has a pointed stern as well as bow, a very high bow and stern. It's ready for a burn pile. When I, your editor, of the, your presenter of the news here, I bought this thing for a dollar from its steward, so to speak, in Grand Marais in 2013. I kind of did a head slap about a week later thinking, what am I doing? But thankfully, Knife River boatwright Larry Ronning and Mike Ojard collaborated on the rebuild plan. Larry also provided the steam bending equipment and hands-on lessons in steam bending. Mike Ojard rebuilt a 1955 Gray Marine Phantom 50 horsepower engine for repowering and also provided the drive and rudder. I planked and decked it. September of 2018, after a five-year rebuild, it was launched at the Knife River Marina, with the surviving waves of three longtime Knife River commercial fishermen christening it. Over the course of time, it had been fished for five different Knife River fishing families. So that's quite a bit of heritage that's been restored with Star. The other boat is Ivor John. It's 20 feet in length and was built in 1948 by the Hill Brothers in Larsmont for Carl Erickson on Knife River. A two-cylinder Red Wing moved it along at about 8 miles an hour, 800 RPM. Carl's son-in-law, Ivor Peterson, ended up owning the Ivor John, and then it went through several hands until Mike Ojard saw it in the field in Clover Valley. Mike and his cousin Rich Ojard became partners in the boat, with Mike restoring the original Red Wing, which was still in Knife River, and Rich bringing it back to sailing condition. Rich took over the Ivor when Mike started the Heritage Marine, a tugboat company now with a fleet of four tugs. In the spring of 27, it became apparent Ivor John needed serious repairs, a new stem and keel. Rich and Larry Ronning collaborated in a structural rebuild plan, and I carried it out, with Rich completing the interior carpentry and repowering Ivor with a 12-horsepower Volvo Penta diesel. Ivor John was launched in early July of 2019. And it's good for many more years. So look at the two gas boats. There's a third boat that is being restored now, and that's the Jackie. It's built by the Hill family. Looks a lot like the Ivor John. Rich Ojard also owns Jackie. Jackie has a 1952 Red Wing four-cylinder engine capable of about 40 miles an hour. It was owned for many years by Hans Ojard, Rich and Mike's uncle, and named after Hans's wife, Now, Hans's son, Gary Ojard, became owner after Hans passed away, and Gary was its steward for many years before cousin Richard acquired it in 2016. Jack is in remarkable good shape and will be made shipshape by Richard and perhaps repowered as well. So, Knife River's commercial fishing heritage and its gas boats are intertwined and are an integral part of the town's colorful history. Should be noted that, in addition to the persons mentioned in the story, that many others from Knife River helped in restoring these boats, from locating, rescuing, and transporting to Knife River, steam bending, which can require up to six people, and to flipping the boats over for hull work and then uprighting them. It takes a village to restore a rotten boat. That's your takeaway from this, is this issue or this episode of our newsletter. Here's one more. In 2015, the Knife River Eula Bien, our Christmas festival, received international recognitions for its authenticity as a Scandinavian celebration of Christmas, with Norwegian National Broadcasting, which is a counterpart to our PBS, sent a news crew to Knife River to capture our interpretation of an authentic Norwegian julebien. Well, they produced a five-minute feature that resulted, and it was aired twice a week later in Norway to approximately 3.5 million people. All of them know about Knife River now. Later, we found out that the person who produced the program was one of Norway's most popular television personalities. That's about the amount of time I've got. More I could go on here, and I'll save this for another issue here or episode. And so I'm going to draw to a close here because I'm out of time. And remember that news from Knife River airs the second Friday of every month here at KTWH, 99.5 FM, second Friday every month at 9 a.m., and then repeated the following Sunday at 1 p.m. And with that, I wish you a good day, and I'll be back next month.